finally got the person in his gun sights who had made his life so miserable, he decided the man was too young to die. Do they make them like that anymore? Yes, they do. Every day. Consider a gunman in Florida who shot a law enforcement officer in the eye. The eye popped like a grape, and the officer fell to the ground. Though he had powder burns in his good eye and a bullet in the other, he drew his sidearm and emptied his magazine into the perpetrator. Later at the inquiry, the officer was asked why he fired all the bullets in his gun into the man. He replied, "Because that's all I had." The officer may have had a bullet in one eye and powder burns in his other, and he may have been down, but he was definitely not out. Do they make them like that anymore? Consider also Officer Stacy Lim from the LAPD, whose story is legendary among professional police warriors. It began when she pulled into a driveway after an enjoyable evening of softball practice. When Lim got out of her personal car, she was immediately confronted by a group of gangbangers who had followed her with the intent of carjacking her vehicle. Her first response was to call out that she was a police officer. They responded by firing a .357 Magnum round into her chest, which penetrated her heart and blew a tennis ball-sized exit wound out her back. Stacy Lim stayed in the fight. She not only returned fire, but she also became the aggressor as she pursued the man, shooting him repeatedly. The remaining gangbangers suddenly remembered previous pressing engagements and very wisely fled for their lives. After she dealt with her attackers, she turned around and headed up her driveway toward her house to call for help. She does not recall doing it, but as she was losing consciousness, she slipped the magazine from her pistol and threw it 20 feet away, where it was found the next day. She did this because in the academy she had been taught, "Don't let them use your weapon against you." Her attacker died, and Stacy Lim died twice on the operating table. She required 101 pints of blood, but she survived, returning to duty 8 months later. Today she is a patrol sergeant on the streets of Los Angeles, and her training philosophy is, you need to prepare your mind for where your body may have to go. Do they make them like that anymore? Although Stacy was the victim of a surprise attack by deadly predators, she not only stayed in the fight, she took the fight to them. She was victorious because she was both physically and mentally prepared. Lim had a competitive attitude that refused to lose, and she had a plan, a visualized determination to win, always to win. Some of the greatest heroes that our nation has seen in years, our law enforcement officers, patrol our streets on a daily basis, doing things that make the Old West pale by comparison. Heroic deeds that never even make the 5 o'clock news. Such is the case of a decorated Detroit police officer named Jessica Wilson, who was shot in the chest and neck with a shotgun at a neighborhood disturbance call. With only seconds of life left, she was able to shoot the assailant with a single shot at 40 feet before she fell. A firefighter was on the scene within minutes, but she was already dead. Warriors like these do not just happen. They are built. They are crafted. They are nurtured every day. Common among so many of them is their ability to suck up gunshot wounds and drive on to accomplish their mission. Read the Medal of Honor citations, and you find that the one commonality in almost all of them is that though the recipients were physically damaged, they drove on. They drove on. If you are shot, step one is, do not panic. The fact you are alive to know you are shot is a good sign. Think of it as a very emphatic warning shot. Say to yourself, I've been better, but I could be worse. Know that a mission, a goal can keep you going. Okay, you've been hit. So now your immediate goal is to prevent getting hit with another bullet. Let's say the person who shot you no longer represents a legitimate lawful threat because he has fled, surrendered, or been shot. Or there are plenty of other people present who can take care of him. Your mission now is to crawl, walk, wriggle, run, writhe, or drive to medical support. Get yourself back to medical support so that your friends don't have to expose themselves getting you back to safety. They have better things to do at this time. As Samuel Butler put it over 300 years ago, "For those that fly may fight again, which he can never do that's slain." Understand that your heart can be stopped by a bullet, and you still can have 5 to 7 seconds left. What are you going to do with it? Lauren Christensen worked a case when he was assigned to Portland's gang enforcement team, where a gangbanger broke into a gun store. As the man exited out the broken front window, he confronted a police officer and raised his newly acquired rifle, but the officer fired first and hit him in the heart. To the officer's amazement, the banger did not die, but ran along the front of the store, around the corner, and continued for another 150 feet before his ripped open heart terminated its host's life force. In another case, an officer was wrestling with the husband at a domestic violence call when the man managed to take the officer's police baton and commits beating him with it. Seriously injured from the multiple blows, the officer pulled his firearm and shot the assailant through the heart. The man dropped the baton and ran across the large living room, yanked open the door, and fell dead a few steps out into the hall. Stacy Lim, the LAPD officer with a bullet through her heart, is living proof that it is entirely possible to survive after being shot in the heart. Some people assume that a headshot will stop them, but we have seen that you can even take a bullet in the eye and keep fighting. Let's say the person who shot you continues to represent a lawful, legitimate threat to your life, and there is no one there to help you deal with him. What are you going to do? Getting back to medical support is not the answer now. Your immediate mission is to stop him from shooting you again. There is nothing you can do about the bullet in you, but you can stop the next bullet by shooting him back. It's only fair. Understand deep in your being that though you are shot, even in the heart or the eye, you can still function. You can call for help, shoot the perpetrator, and/or get yourself to safety. Know that with today's incredible medical technology, you have a greater chance of surviving than at any other time in history. The key is to stop him from putting any more bullets in you. In most cases, that means killing the SOB who just shot you. And, in the end, as Longfellow put it, "Ye are better than all the ballads that ever were sung or said, for ye are living poems and all the rest are dead." The will to kill, daunting and deterring your opponent. You are the weapon. Everything else is just a tool. Anonymous. As a cop or a peacekeeper, your job is not to kill. It is to serve and protect. To do that, you may have to kill. First, you want to deter and then stop the threat. The most effective way to stop someone is to fire a bullet into his central nervous system. It is up to God and the paramedics as to whether the man dies. Your job is to stop the deadly threat, and the most effective way to do that is to make the threat die. Whether you are a warrior hunting terrorists in a distant land, a peacekeeper in Bosnia, or a law enforcement officer patrolling our mean streets, there are rules of engagement in which deadly force can be used under authority. When you do it right, as you have been trained, the threat may die, a possibility you must accept as a warrior. As a soldier or a Marine in active combat, there's far less ambiguity. Your job is to kill the enemy. If he surrenders first, that is fine, because that is what we want, and you will play by the rules and accept his surrender. However, one of the best ways to convince him to surrender is to kill sufficient numbers of his friends and leaders. You must accept the fact that you might have to kill. As a cop, a peacekeeper, or a combat soldier, what will you gain by accepting this dirty, nasty, four-letter word, kill? First, you will not respond with panic to a deadly threat. The worst thing in the world is Barney Fife with a bullet in his gun. "Oh my God, I might have to kill him." The correct response is this: "I think I'm going to have to kill this guy. I knew it might come to this someday." By completely accepting the possibility, you maintain control of yourself and are better able to deter your opponent. Deterrence is something that law enforcement officers do over and over as peacekeepers in the streets of America. And it is something that soldiers do in the volatile streets of foreign lands. When people know that warriors are present, they slow their cars. They do not rob convenience stores, and they are less likely to commit deadly acts in the name of politics and religion. Warriors daunt and deter. Their very presence can save lives and stop killing. Here are two case studies in deterrence. One is a tragedy, and the other a famous success story. First, the tragedy. One summer day in August 2000, I volunteered my time to train a major city police department that was experiencing a crisis of confidence as a result of a recent violent incident. A man had fired a rifle at his girlfriend and then fled with officers in close pursuit. The suspect screeched to a stop in a driveway, with one police car pulling up behind him and the other stopping further away. The officers in both cars got out and took cover behind their vehicles. The suspect, armed with a .30 M1 carbine rifle, began advancing on the closest officers. As he got near their car, the officer shouted, "Police, drop the gun! Police, drop the gun! Stop, stop!" The officers in the car that was furthest away shouted to the closer officers, "Shoot him! Shoot him! Shoot him!" But no one shot, and the suspect continued to advance until he moved around the police car and came upon one of the exposed officers. "Don't hurt me," the officer said, setting his weapon on the ground. What do wolves do to sheep? They rip their throats out. That is what happened in this case. The suspect fired, and the .30 round blew out the officer's spinal cord, leaving the officer paralyzed from the neck down. Sadly, this officer died from his wound 2 years later. Only after the officer fell did the officer's partner open fire and drop the suspect. As a warrior, you might one day face the single most difficult task any person will ever have to face, to decide whether to use deadly force and take a life. Most likely, you will have to make that decision in a split second in the most toxic, corrosive environment known to man, combat, the realm of the universal human phobia. If you choose to take a life when you should not, or if you fail to take a human life when you should, a world of hurt will come down on you. This is not an impossible task. It is a hero's task, a warrior's task. It is immensely difficult. But if we did not have men and women willing to walk out the door and face that challenge every day, within the span of a generation, our civilization would no longer exist. The time to decide whether you can kill another human being is not in the middle of battle. The time to decide, to the utmost of your ability, is right now. Dr. Ignatius Piazza puts it very clearly and succinctly to every student at his Front Sight Firearms Training Institute. These are terrible decisions to make, and we would like to avoid them at all costs. However, if you do not make the decisions in advance, I guarantee you that you will hesitate to make them later, and that hesitation may make the difference between you living and dying. Understand that no one can ever be 100% certain. We all exist in a state of uncertainty. Even those who have been there before do not know for sure whether they can do a good job the next time. But to the utmost of your ability, you must resolve now, in your heart and mind, that you can kill. In 2002, I received the following email from a law enforcement officer. A young man set fire to his ex-wife's home and ran on foot. The officers arriving in the area heard gunshots and reported them on the radio. As I arrived on the scene, a suspect ran out in front of my car, no more than 3 feet away, shooting at the other officers. For some reason, he ignored me, though I was the closest to him. He charged the officers, shooting multiple times. I received 2 rounds of friendly fire through my front windshield, missing my head by less than a foot. I drew my weapon and fired 4 rounds through my windshield, evidently hitting him at least 2 times because he fell to the ground 25 feet from me. He realized I was the one hitting him and he turned around and fired approximately 8 rounds into my car. Still sitting, I fired 8 more rounds at him until he stopped firing at me. He was hit 9 times. After the shooting, I found out that he had shot a deputy who had been pursuing him 8 times, killing him. He had also entered a residence and killed an 85-year-old man by shooting him 12 times. There was absolutely no hesitation in my firing, though I had difficulty drawing my weapon as it was tangled in the seatbelt. But once out and on target, I did my job well. Your lecture, The Bulletproof Mind, and your book on killing had assisted me in removing all doubt from my mind that I could take a life in defense of myself and others. My lack of hesitation and no second thoughts proved that to me. I have served as a police officer 27 years, and although I have come close many times, this was my first shooting. Because of your lecture and book, I had already dealt with the religious aspects of taking a life, and I knew what emotions to expect after the shooting. Your insight into these areas was most helpful to me. As I attended the deputy's funeral, I found it difficult to grieve for him because I was so glad the funeral was not for me. Because I had considered all this prior to the shooting, and because I knew to expect it, it was much easier to deal with. There is a growing trend in this country of active shooters attempting to take multiple lives quickly. It is important that we train our officers to understand and be prepared for these people, because the only way to survive these incidents is to act without hesitation. They have to be prepared in advance to accomplish this. It is truly an honor to be of service to warriors such as this, and the greatest service I can provide is to help them prepare ahead of time to kill if need be. Every human on earth is insecure. Those who can admit it are a little more secure than those who cannot. The finest baseball pitcher in the world and the greatest football quarterback on the planet wake up in the morning and are not sure if they are going to play a good game. They are determined to do their very best, but they know from experience that they will have good days and bad days. They learn from the bad days and rejoice in the good days, but always they know that they can never be sure. This is simply being human, and it is why we have superstitions. It is why there are baseball players who insist on wearing their lucky socks, actors who never whistle backstage, and why in Vietnam our soldiers would leave the death card on their fallen foes, a symbol feared by the superstitious North Vietnamese. To the utmost of your ability, you must face your insecurity and resolve the issue of using deadly force in your mind. Look deep into yourself and ask, can I do what my society calls upon me to do? Who decides how much force the warrior has to use? Who ultimately makes the decision that deadly force is needed? The suspect does. The enemy does. The threat does. He fights, you fight. When he uses deadly force, you use deadly force. He makes that decision for you. He has the option to surrender, and your job is to respond with what society says is your right and responsibility to do. This is why it is paramount that you resolve in your mind whether you can do it ahead of time. Only when you know you can respond will you have the ability to truly deter people. That is the great paradox of combat. If you are truly prepared to kill someone, you are less likely to have to do it. That person will look into your eyes and see the steely determination to kill him and be less eager to attack and more likely to surrender. Having that steely determination in your eyes is not about practicing your evil eye in the mirror, although there's nothing wrong with that. It is about having made the decision in your heart ahead of time. There is a statue of a Texas Ranger in the main lobby of the airport in Houston, Texas. He wears a hat, boots, a gun on each hip, and a little star. The statue commemorates the Texas Rangers, and it commemorates the warrior spirit. The story began when the mayor notified the Rangers of a riot in his city, and that he desperately needed their help. A couple of hours later, one lonely ranger stepped off the train, the man whose image is now depicted in the airport. Shocked, the mayor asked, "They only sent one ranger?" The ranger shrugged and replied, "You only got one riot." The big Texas ranger walked into the middle of the mob, wearing his hat, boots, little star, the hog legs strapped on each hip, and carrying a shotgun. All it took was one look at this man, and every one of those rioters went home. They left because they had looked into the eyes of a man who was playing the game for real. His posture, his bearing, his demeanor, his voice, his reputation, and his organization all said one thing. He was fully prepared to kill them if that's what the job called for. The rioters knew that the stakes were too high, and they took their marbles and went home. Engraved at the base of that statue in Houston's Hobby Airport are these words, "One riot, one ranger." Someday, I would like to make a statue to the American law enforcement officer, and at its base, it would read, "One crime, one cop." Now, an officer or any warrior doesn't want to be the Lone Ranger. He wants all the backup he can get. However, if the situation is one in which there is only one lone warrior at the scene, then that can be enough if the warrior is armed mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. If he has prepared himself and invested himself as a warrior, he will be ready. Here again is the great paradox of combat. When you are truly prepared to kill someone, you are less likely to have to do it. The will to live. Get up, get up. If he can do it, I can too. The smallest worm will turn, being trodden on. Shakespeare, King Henry VI. One of your primary goals as a warrior is to train and mentally condition yourself to keep going when you have been shot. You must understand and accept that you might get wounded, and understand deeply and intensely that you will keep fighting until the threat is no longer present. You can do it, and you must do it. You must control and direct the power of your adrenaline. One law enforcement officer shot a perpetrator 5 times with his .45 caliber handgun. He was an undercover narcotics officer and had just made a buy from a drug dealer. The backup officer swooped in to make the arrest, only to be met by a hail of gunfire from the drug dealer. What would you do if you were this warrior and suddenly the perpetrator was shooting your friends? You would shoot him, and as a result of your action, you would probably kill him. Remember, it is really up to God and the medics whether he lives or dies. In this case, the undercover officer shot the perp with multiple .45 caliber rounds, killing him. Later, the officer expressed his amazement that it had taken so many bullets. "I always thought when you hit somebody with a .45, they just kind of flew away like on TV. I shot the guy 5 times before he dropped." Later, the same officer got into another gunfight. This time, the officer got hit and he went down. As he lay there, he says that he thought back on his first shooting, where it had taken 5 big rounds to drop the perp. The officer said to himself, "Get up, get up. If he can do it, I can too." That is exactly what you need to tell yourself. Every time you hear about a gangbanger sucking up rounds and driving on, every time you hear about some Medal of Honor recipient sucking up damage and driving on, every time you hear about a cop taking a bullet through the heart and driving on, say to yourself, "If that person can do it, I can too." On getting shot, bone hits, blood loss, and blistering incoming fire. Who doomed to go in company with pain and fear and bloodshed, miserable train, turns his necessity to glorious gain. Wordsworth, Character of the Happy Warrior. Should a bullet slam into you, what can you expect? Sometimes in the heat of battle, warriors are not aware that they have been shot until later. But those who are aware of it usually experience the normal stress responses: dry mouth, sweaty palms, and a racing heart rate. We know that sometimes our sense of pain can shut down, so that tissue wounds do not hurt. But those who have been shot say that bone hits can be extremely painful. While that is important to know, it is also important to understand that no one dies of broken bones. A law enforcement officer lay on the floor in the back of a bus after being shot twice. One round hit a leg bone, and a second went in his chest. From where he lay, he could look under the seats and see the feet of this criminal coming to finish him off. He said that he was bleeding his life out in this dirty bus, and all he could think about was, why does the bullet in my leg hurt so bad, and this one doesn't hurt at all? After a moment, the officer realized, as he watched the suspect's feet get closer and closer, that maybe he had something more important to worry about right then. He had become distracted at this critical moment because no one had told him how different types of wounds could hurt. It is all about prior preparation. You must also be prepared for blood loss. If you get holes punched in your body, blood will come out. On rare occasions, the contents of your intestines may come out too. But do not worry about that, because someone will clean it up. But most of the time, blood is going to come out. How much? Well, your body holds approximately 1.5 gallons of blood, and you can lose 30%, approximately half a gallon, 2 liters, without losing your hydraulics. To see what that much blood looks like, take a half gallon of strawberry milk and pour it on the ground. Yes, it is a large puddle, but tell yourself that that is the volume of blood you can lose and still fight. Erase all doubt that you can keep going and keep fighting. Know that if you stop before you lose that much blood, it is your will that failed and not your body. Sucking up damage and driving on. That is what great warriors do. Consider this narrative of Special Operations soldiers in Afghanistan from the online column of that great warrior author, Colonel David Hackworth. Earlier, the platoon, 1st Platoon of Alpha Company, 1st 75th Rangers, had been spread across the battlefield on separate missions. When word came down to find MIA, Navy SEAL Neil Roberts, the lead element air assaulted, its chopper shot to smithereens upon landing, and the Rangers and air crew were stuck on a rocky ridge surrounded by a large, well-dug-in Al-Qaeda force. Because of blistering enemy incoming fire, a 1st Platoon reinforcing element landed by chopper at the base of the mountain, about a mile from the besieged warriors. The 10 men began clawing their way toward the top, loaded down with 100 pounds of kit, on what would prove to be a 5,000-foot, almost vertical, 3-hour climb. And throughout this nearly mission-impossible feat, they were battered by enemy rifle and mortar fire that wounded several of these elite warriors. When the Rangers got to the top, they busted through the enemy's bunker line and linked up with their surrounded mates. But they soon found themselves waist-high in snow, the thermometer hovering around zero, in an increasingly hotter frying pan, with incoming RPGs, recoilless rifle fire, mortars thumping in, and bullets snapping like angry bees across the open plain at 12,000 feet. An SAS commando who watched the fight said, "These blokes, along with their tactical aircraft and chopper air support, killed a bloody lot of them." Apart from their own incredible guts, the air support, virtually on top of them, is what kept them alive. If U.S. Air Force Combat Air Controller Kevin Vance wasn't on the ground, bravely directing the fire, it would have been taps for all these good men. Ranger Mark Anderson said, "This is where all the training pays off," before catching one with his name on it while bounding toward the enemy. Ranger Bradley Kroos was hit in the head by a round that smashed under his helmet and out the back of his head, and Ranger Matthew Commons went down for the count as well. Air Force warrior Jason Cunningham was hit by 2 rounds in the gut and lay out in the bitter cold, slowly bleeding to death. when the Rangers' rifles were shot up, had malfunctioned, or the men ran out of ammo. The Rangers policed up Al-Qaeda weapons and waded into the fanatics, wasting them with their own bullets. For almost 18 long, blood-soaked hours, it was often hand-to-hand fighting with knives, pistols, and rifle butts. That terrible night, the Rangers were supported by U.S. Air Force C-130 Spectre gunships. That, according to an Aussie SAS commando on a nearby knob, lit up the hills around them. It was bloody amazing. The most beautiful yet fearsome sight I've ever seen, he said. Those who were hit never faltered, continuing to put heavy fire on the enemy in the fiercest kind of combat and freezing conditions our forces have seen since the Korean War. Right now, you have to develop the will and the resolve to live. Know that if you keep going until medical help arrives, you will probably survive. If you stop your attacker from shooting you again. Understand that every passing day, our evacuation, communication, and medical technology progresses by leaps and bounds. Today, warriors survive horrific gunshot wounds that would have been fatal only 10 years ago. Accept that you might get hit and know that you will survive it. Being a warrior, living a life of alert readiness, and staying in condition yellow means that you notice the good as well as the bad. Consider these anonymous words written on the wall of a bunker in Saigon. You have never lived until you have almost died. For those who fight for it, life has a flavor the protected will never know. At the end of the day, when you go home and hug your loved ones and taste that meal prepared with love, it will have a flavor the protected will never know. The sheep spend a lifetime eating grass, but you taste the flavor the protected will never know. That may be the warrior's greatest reward. Fight for it, fight for it, fight for it. Never, never give up. Consider this powerful narrative of survival and determination from a great warrior trainer, Pete Solis. As I was in the process of drawing my weapon and ordering the driver to show his hands, I stepped to the right instead of stepping back and away from his vehicle, thus placing me in what we refer to as a fatal funnel. I was no more than 2 feet from his passenger window and looking into the eyes of a smiling, cold-blooded killer. That's when he took advantage of my stepping where I had no business being. While seated in his vehicle, the suspect lunged toward the passenger side, firing one of 2 handguns he had concealed. The first round struck me in my vest, causing me to stumble backwards. Although I knew the suspect was still firing rounds at me, I no longer could hear the shots. Everything was moving in slow motion, and my peripheral vision was non-existent. All I could see at this point was the driver now standing outside his door with a 2-handed grip on a black semi-automatic handgun. The slide was recoiling back and forth in slow motion, ejecting spent rounds over his right shoulder. I knew if I were going to survive this attack, I would have to fight through this state of mind and seek cover immediately. No sooner had that thought entered my mind than I felt a second round impact my left arm just above the wrist, and then a third round strike my left forearm, causing me to drop my flashlight. Then another round struck my left thigh. I fell to my knee, now returning fire at the driver, who was still smiling at me, as if he were enjoying the target practice. Apparently, several rounds I fired hit their mark and caused the driver to seek cover as he continued to fire. I sprinted toward the rear of my car, but just as I was reaching it, I felt a bullet impact my left shoulder. I saw the material on my shirt sleeve blow open as the bullet passed through my shoulder and exited the left biceps. The gunfight continued, with a volley of rounds exchanged with both of us using our vehicles for cover. The wound I had sustained to my left thigh was now pumping blood onto the trunk of my cruiser. Fearing that a major artery may have been struck, I feared that I was probably going to bleed to death in a short time. A relative calm came over me. I made the decision to end this deadly confrontation now, regardless if I had to take more rounds to do it. The driver was not leaving this parking lot to hurt anyone else. He had been the predator up to this point, and now it was my turn. I dropped the magazine from my weapon and inserted a fresh one. Apparently, he saw the empty magazine hit the ground and figured I was out of ammunition, or maybe he assumed I had succumbed to my injuries and knelt behind my cruiser to die. Regardless of reason, he left his cover and was coming to finish me off. I was now crouched low behind the left rear bumper of my car. I distinctly remember telling myself to wait, wait until he is closer. I could clearly see the driver's feet as he slowly approached. I waited until he got at least 3 or 4 feet from the front of the car before I made my move. Staying low, I lunged from around my car, firing accurately into the suspect's chest and continuing to fire as I advanced. I remember the smile leaving my assailant's face as he stumbled backward toward his vehicle. He turned, gun in hand, and dove over the rear of the car, landing out of my sight. He entered and started his car in an attempt to flee. I stumbled forward, firing through the rear windshield of the suspect's vehicle until it came to a stop, and the suspect sat, mortally wounded. Pete Solis now trains warriors worldwide, using his experience to teach others. Survive. Get on with life and live it to the fullest, savoring every day. That may be a warrior's greatest reward. As Dave Rivore, Second Chance Body Armor Save 777, put it, that short span of 5 minutes felt like the longest 5 minutes in time. Those 5 minutes have given me the new perspective that Christmas is every day. It has been said that we only get one spin at life, but once in a while, we may get another. What we do with it will determine whether or not it is deserved. Perchance to dream, a universal warrior nightmare. Like a dog, he hunts in dreams. Tennyson, Locksley Hall. After you have been in a combat situation, it is normal to have nightmares about that experience. Slowly but surely, those nightmares should fade away. Years later, they may pop up again, sometimes for no obvious reason, and that too appears to be a fairly common part of the healing process. But there is a kind of dream not associated with any real-world event. I call it the universal warrior nightmare. The most common version of the universal nightmare is a dream that you cannot get your gun to fire. The gun jams, the bullets dribble out the end of the barrel, or they bounce impotently off the bad guy's chest. I have interviewed many World War II and Vietnam veterans who had nightmares that their rifles would not work. I asked an audience of SEALs and Green Berets who had just returned from Afghanistan how many had ever had the gun doesn't work dream, and nearly all of them raised their hands. When I asked that question of my law enforcement audiences, usually over 90% of them raised their hands. The dream can take other variations. People who have spent time training in the martial arts and officers who train extensively in defensive tactics might consistently dream that their techniques or their blows do not work. People who have been in traffic accidents may dream that their brakes don't work. Usually, it is the gun that fails. This is called a performance anxiety dream. Your handgun, rifle, or empty hand fighting techniques are representative of your ability to deal with danger. You are a warrior, and your job is to go into danger. When you truly accept that fact, when there is no denial left in you, it is reasonable to be concerned. And the puppy, your midbrain, your unconscious mind sends a message into your dreams that says, "Boss, I'm worried. I'm afraid it might not work." Well, who would not be worried? There is peace in simply understanding that you are not alone. that these kinds of dreams are common among warriors. Many of your brother and sister warriors have such nightmares, and there is nothing wrong if you are having them now or if you get them in the future. But there is one thing you can do that has helped many warriors to make the dreams go away. Train. The puppy is worried. So to calm him, you teach him a few new tricks or polish the old ones. Train hard so that he feels confident. I know an officer who is a member of one of our nation's most elite SWAT teams. He goes into harm's way on a daily basis and is confronted by deadly force encounters on a weekly basis. He tells me that every 6 weeks, like clockwork, his nightmares return. To make them go away, he goes out to the firing range on a Saturday and fires hundreds of rounds. He particularly likes to shoot at steel targets, the kind that produce an audible clank when struck and then drop down. My weapon turns into a magic wand. Wherever I point it, things fall down and my nightmares go away. For some people, the nightmares pass when they are no longer in danger. Others seem to learn how to win in their dreams, to will themselves to win, even if it means picking up a big rock and smacking their enemy with it, or defeating an endless stream of attackers until their opponents finally give up. However, if the nature of your work is that every day you face combat, or the possibility of combat, one possible solution is to train. The midbrain, or the mammalian brain, truly is like having a puppy inside. The only way to communicate to your puppy is to train him. I have two dogs, a Labrador Retriever and a German Shepherd, my elite crack security team. I cannot talk to my dogs and tell them, all right, I'm going to be gone for a week, so you guys are in charge. You got the front door, and you've got the back door. It's not like Scooby-Doo, where they say, "All right, boss," and go do it. In the real world, the only way you can communicate to your dog is to train him. The same is true with a puppy inside. The one quality all good police dogs have in common is competence, verging on cockiness. This is because they have been highly trained, and they know that there is nothing the world can throw at them that they cannot handle. Have you ever seen a person that just exudes confidence under stress? You can't fake it. It is a product of training and experience. If you are having performance anxiety dreams, it may mean that the puppy doesn't have that confidence. The only sure way to get it is through training. The warrior masters his realm. He does not flee from his fear. He conquers it. Chapter 4. Making the Decision to Kill. I killed someone, but someone lived. There are two ways to look at it. Some people are so disgusted by the fact that they have killed someone, and further disgusted by the legal system, that they quit. Statistics say that around 50% quit, and I can see how that happens. It's a dirty part of the job, and there certainly is no part of me that wants it to happen again. On the other hand, it is a very necessary part of our job. After all, we keep the peace. And sometimes that takes a lot. The other way to look at it is this. Sure, I killed someone, but someone lived. Someone who was not going to live 1 second longer is instead alive because I did. The woman I killed had two small children who don't have a mother anymore. I'm sorry about that. Regardless of how messed up she was, I'm sure her own children loved her. I would have preferred it ended another way, but that wasn't up to me. She made the call. Every single man on my team has kids too. It was my responsibility to make sure when sugar turns to shit, they all went home, and they did. They went home to their families, and no matter what else happens, I can't help but be proud of that fact. Russ Claggett, After the Echo. I would argue that we are in the most violent time in peacetime human history. Remember that the murder rate is being held down by medical technology, but the rate at which our citizens are trying to harm and kill each other, the per capita aggravated assault rate, is up fivefold since 1957. And similar increases have occurred in nations around the globe. Remember, we have terrorists racking up the Guinness World Record body count for international terrorist acts, the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center, and domestic terrorist activity, racking up all-time record domestic mass murder, the Oklahoma City bombing. The result is a war on crime and a war on terrorism, at home and abroad, unlike anything seen before. In these violent times, we must know if we have warriors capable of doing the job. In the area of law enforcement, we need a sure way of screening for shooters so that we know they are going to be able to pull the trigger. Lauren Christensen tells of a rookie officer in his agency who was not only incapable of shooting someone, but he would not even wear his sidearm. The officer was hired in the winter, and because he wore a long, heavy uniform jacket, his training partner did not know that the rookie was locking his entire web belt and firearm in the car trunk at the beginning of each shift. When the training officer finally caught on, about 3 weeks later, he immediately drove the rookie back to the precinct. The new man was terminated a few days later, and rightfully so. Now, this man may have been a wonderful husband and father, and an outstanding citizen, but he had no business in police work. The skill and the will to kill. Champions aren't made in the gym. Champions are made from something they have deep inside them, a desire, a dream, a vision. They have to have last-minute stamina. They have to be a little faster. They have to have the skill and the will. But the will must be stronger than the skill. Muhammad Ali, world champion boxer. You need three things to survive in armed combat: the weapon, the skill, and the will to kill. What if you do not have a weapon? Will that make the people you are sworn to protect safer when someone tries to kill them? No. Even the British police, the famous Bobbies, are increasingly armed in order to serve and protect in our modern, ultra-violent world. If there was anything that proves the point of our ever-growing violence around the globe, it is probably the arming of the Bobbies. What about the skill? Training. Should we take the all-too-common approach that implies that guns are nasty and icky and not spend any appreciable time training because we do not want gunfighters? No. Because without training, your gun would not do you any good. Indeed, you are likely to be a significant risk to the people you are supposed to protect. Is it a good thing if you have the weapon and the skill, but not the will to pull the trigger? Of course not, because someone who does have the ability to kill will take that weapon away from you and use it on you or the people you are supposed to protect. If at the moment of truth you cannot pull the trigger, then all your training and all your equipment are wasted, and the lives of those you are sworn to protect will be wasted, and you will be an abject failure. If you are going to have the weapon, then you must have the will to kill. How is the will developed? In my co-author's book, The Mental Edge, Lauren Christensen writes about a champion martial artist who spent decades developing his personal weapons, but had doubts as to whether he could use them in the harsh reality of the streets. Christensen writes, "I know one champion karate fighter who has earned so many trophies that if they were melted down, he could build a dozen full-size cars. He can put his fist or foot wherever he wants, and there isn't much his opponent can do about it. In addition to his incredible physical skill, he has a trait rare among champions, especially fighters like him who have graced the covers of martial arts magazines. That trait is honesty. He has told me more than once that he has doubts as to how well he would do in a real fight, a bloodletting, knockdown, dragout. I can play tournament tag, he says. But if I had to fight for real, I don't know how I would do. Here is a guy whose techniques are incredibly fast, awesomely powerful, and who can deliver them with the precise timing of a Swiss watch. With the right attitude, my friend could be the terror of the streets. But he doesn't have this attitude because he wasn't born with it. His environment growing up didn't require it, and he has never made an effort to train for it. Later in The Mental Edge, Christensen talks about his own mental preparation to take a life and his job as a police officer. Early in his career, he came to a place in his thinking where he absolutely knew he could shoot and kill with the weapons provided by his police agency. Then the veteran martial artist considered the act of killing with his empty hands and his role as a police officer. He writes, "It's one thing pulling a trigger when I'm several feet away from a threat, but it is much more personal to beat the life out of someone with my feet and hands. What if a bad guy disarmed me and I had to fight him hand to hand? Could I kill him to protect myself?" I answered, yes. I got into a lot of fights as a police officer. While the thought of killing was not a conscious one every time I struggled with the resistor, I was comfortable knowing that if the fight deteriorated and turned into a survival situation, I was mentally prepared to use deadly force with my hands. Is this thinking sick? No, it is smart. As a police officer, I was paid to protect the community, which meant that in an extreme situation, I might have to use deadly force. That's what I got paid the big bucks for. If I was unable to use that level of force, and I was killed, or an innocent person was killed, what good was I as a protector? How we select police officers is a step toward the right direction. Portland, Oregon had a selection test that is discussed in Deadly Force Encounters. Portland does not use it anymore because it has been deemed there as politically incorrect. But it has been picked up by other agencies nationwide. Part of their test involved an interview board that asked how candidates for the position of police officer would handle various situations. One question that really revealed candidates' common sense and their willingness to use deadly force went like this. You're a law enforcement officer. You are trained, equipped, and on foot patrol. You come around a corner and find in front of you a chain link fence topped with barbed wire, extending as far as you can see to the left and right. Just on the other side of that chain link fence is a law enforcement officer lying helpless on the ground as someone kicks him repeatedly in the head. What do you do? The correct answer would be that you would pull your weapon, order him to stop, and if he continued to assault the officer, you would shoot him. End of discussion. The candidates, though, were not sure how to answer, so they would hedge their bets. Some would say that they would climb over the fence, and the panel would tell them that the fence was topped with barbed wire. I'm going to go under the fence, a couple of them said, and the panel would say that it was on concrete. Well, I'll go around the fence. The panel would inform them that the fence went all the way around the enclosed area. I'm going to call the helicopter. Sorry, but the helicopter is busy. This would continue as the candidates tried every possible answer to avoid having to use their weapons. In the end, 2 candidates out of 10 would not tell the panel that they would shoot the assailant, even though there were no other options. Now, these people are probably wonderful human beings, and I am proud to be on the same planet with them. But the technical term for their interview is disqualified. Lest you think these people answered this way because they were only police applicants, consider a paint bullet scenario that was given to sworn veteran police officers in Nebraska. In the scenario, they were told that they had received an officer needs help call with shots fired. When they got to the scene, they would find the officer down with the suspect pointing a gun at the officer's head. I'm going to kill him, the suspect says. I'm going to kill him. The tricky part of the scenario was that the suspect had his back turned to the officer. When the officers were faced with this situation, one in which they were fully authorized to shoot the man, the majority would not fire, and would do so only after the suspect shot the officer in the head. A significant minority of officers would not even fire then, but would wait until the suspect pointed the weapon toward them. Of course, then, it would be an action-reaction situation, and the officers would probably lose. Waiting for the suspect to shoot the officer or point his weapon at you is not an action that saves lives. Warriors need to decide in advance, to the best of their ability, that they can do the right thing when the time comes. Here is a letter that I received from a SWAT officer. I would like to ask you for a bit of advice. As of late, every SWAT call-out, every warrant, and most of the drug-by busts that I have been involved with, I find myself spending most of my prep time, gearing up, etc., thinking about how I would handle the aftermath of killing the person we are after. I do not spend any time on the actual event of the shooting, hand-to-hand, knife, or act of killing the person, but with thoughts of the aftermath. Is my family going to be all right with what has happened? How is my mother going to handle it? What lawyer should I call? And so on. I have talked with all of them about killing people before, but until recently, I never gave it much thought. I have all the answers and questions pre-answered, and they always come out the same. However, I am spending a great deal of mental energy dealing with this. I don't have any regrets or real concerns. However, I get this ever-growing feeling that the actual act is forthcoming. Is this something that I should worry about? Is this normal, or am I going off the deep end? I have been passing it off as just good prep for the possible combat. But then, you never know. I might be going loony. This was my reply. I don't think this is loony at all. I think it's part of the growing process that a mature warrior must go through, resolving the issues in your mind, thinking them over, and deciding what you will do ahead of time. Such thinking is the next step in officer survival, and I congratulate you on working your way through this level of warriorhood. I predict in the next couple of months, or even years, that this will resolve itself in your mind, and you will come out the other end a superior warrior, functioning at a higher level of preparedness and maturity. Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall, in his classic book, Men Against Fire, spoke clearly of this resistance to killing and the average healthy soldier. The Army, Marshall says, must reckon with the fact that the soldier comes from a civilization in which aggression connected with the taking of a life is prohibited and unacceptable. The teaching and ideals of that civilization are against killing, against taking the advantage. The fear of aggression has been expressed to him so strongly and absorbed by him so deeply and pervasively, practically with his mother's milk, that it is part of the normal man's emotional makeup. This is his greatest handicap when he enters combat. It stays his trigger finger, even though he is hardly conscious that it is a restraint upon him. In Deadly Force Encounters, Dr. Art Wall and Lauren Christensen address this issue head-on. An officer who is uncertain whether he can shoot someone, or an officer who for religious or moral reasons knows he will not shoot a human being, should not be in a police car, and, for that matter, should not be in police work. Such an officer is a detriment to other officers and to the public he is sworn to protect. They all depend upon him to do the right thing when the situation calls for it. If that means taking another person's life, they need to know he will do it, and without hesitation. An unwillingness to shoot is in no way a bad reflection on him as a person, but it does mean he needs to find another line of work. With the ever-increasing dangers on the street, every person considering a career in law enforcement, every rookie just beginning to experience the reality of police work, and every veteran officer who has discovered that his outlook on life and on the job has changed as the years have passed, needs to soul search to decide whether they can